Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 13, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call, Religious Liberty versus Non-Discrimination, Reconcilable or Intractable? My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Peter Kersenow, who is a commissioner for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. For this call, I will turn it over to Peter, and he will get us started with opening remarks. After that, we will open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Peter. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Nate, and good afternoon, everybody. First, I want to correct one thing. I am not an expert under any circumstances when it comes to religious liberties. In my day job, I'm a labor and employment lawyer, and I don't even act like an expert on TV with respect to this matter. But in any event, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, on which I served or do continue to serve, issued a report recently called Peaceful Coexistence, Reconciling Non-Discrimination Principles with Civil Liberties. And Peaceful Coexistence, the title of the report, originally had a question mark after it as to whether or not these two concepts could be reconciled. And that question was resolved by the majority on the commission in the negative in terms of whether or not there could be peaceful coexistence. And their view, contained in the report of the commission and the statements of most of the majority members, would suggest that issues of religious liberty should defer to precepts of non-discrimination, or at least should be subordinate to non-discrimination. About 6 years ago, I proposed this particular topic because of the increasing tension between matters of religious liberty and principles of non-discrimination. We had a hearing about 3.5 years ago, and it's only been recently that the report was issued. During that 3.5 year period, the need for some type of assessment as to whether or not the two concepts could be reconciled became even more urgent, what some people I think would perceive as almost an increasing animus or hostility toward matters related to religious liberty. We saw this from the EEOC, from the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, HHS, and other places that sought to take interpretations of statutes, of rules and regulations that were very aggressive in curbing what in the past had been perceived as unremarkable rights on the part of religious folks. The report was criticized quite heavily, and the criticism has come from a number of quarters. The U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, Archbishop William Laurie, a number of other religious groups and organizations, interfaith leaders from every religion, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, Mormon, African Methodist, Episcopal, Evangelical, Southern Baptist, and Speaker Ryan weighed in, Senator Hatch, and others. There were, I think, if I were going to distill the criticisms, they would come in two forms, and they were parallel to the dissents written by Commissioner Gail Harriet, my colleague on the commission, and some of them involved some of the criticisms that I had. First is that the majority, this particular report, resolved most conflicts between the two principles, that is, religious liberty and non-discrimination, in a manner that would seem to favor non-discrimination or give primacy to principles of non-discrimination. The second reason for the criticism was a set of statements made by the chairman of the commission in his statement, and which was echoed by certain statements in the majority report itself and the statements of individual majority commissioners. And the best way of describing it is to simply quote it. He says, "Religious liberty and religious freedom will stand for nothing except hypocrisy so long as they remain code words for discrimination, intolerance, racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, Christian supremacy, or any form of intolerance," end quote. He had another statement that noted that religion is used to, or was used to, justify slavery and Jim Crow, and I'm not sure what the salience of that point was, other than to suggest that for that reason, non-discrimination should be, or non-discrimination principles should be afforded a broader berth. Not only were those statements fundamentally ahistorical, but they ignore the fact that religion, or those motivated by religion, was central to the abolitionist movement and the civil rights movement, and furthermore fails to appreciate the distinction between religious freedom, that is, freedom from government coercion, and anti-discrimination, which in the final analysis is the use of government authority to coerce people. Now, that might be a benevolent purpose, or the reason for the coercion may be benevolent. It may be something with which we agree to. We may think it is salutary, but it is nonetheless coercion versus freedom. In fact, I think my colleague Commissioner Harriet had maybe the most priceless quote, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think she quoted in a footnote Patrick Henry, and she said, "Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death, not give me non-discrimination or give me death." And I think the majority on the commission in this report misapprehends the distinction between those two concepts. There were a number of findings and recommendations, and I don't want to bore you with each and every one of them, but there are certain ones that merit mention. First, one of the findings was that non-discrimination protections are of preeminent importance in American jurisprudence. Now, again, in terms of history, I'm not sure that we can credibly say that principles of non-discrimination are preeminent or of preeminent importance in American jurisprudence. After all, our first freedom, or at least colloquially described as our first freedom, was religious liberty, as contained in the First Amendment. It was there for more than 200 years. It's one of the reasons why, religious liberty that is, that many people came here in the first place, both at the founding and thereafter, for the ability to engage in the free exercise of their religious beliefs, versus principles of non-discrimination, which temporally, relatively speaking, emerged maybe 5 minutes ago. I mean, I don't mean to give it short shrift, but in the grand scheme of things, where religious liberty was there at the founding, principles of non-discrimination, potentially 14th Amendment, if you look at the 13th, 15th Amendments, if you choose to characterize those as non-discrimination amendments, I'll let you do that, but it still would post-date religious liberty by a considerable period of time. And religious exemptions to non-discrimination, where permissible, this is one of their findings, religious exemptions to non-discrimination, where permissible, infringe on these non-discrimination protections. Now, if you think about that finding for a second, it seems to be completely unremarkable, and it is. In fact, it doesn't say anything that, sure, if you have exemptions to non-discrimination, they're going to infringe on non-discrimination. Except when you view it in the totality of the report as a whole. While unremarkable in isolation, when you look at it in that regard, it is, it seems to me, very secularist in its approach, but not merely secularist. It seems to elevate secularism to a religion in and of itself. They say that religious exceptions to civil rights protections should be tailored and construed as narrowly as possible. Okay. Again, something very unremarkable, except when you look at one of their recommendations, and that is that they recommend, the majority that is, recommends that Congress clarify RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, so that the Free Exercise Clause gives rights only to religious institutions and individuals to the extent they don't unduly burden rights and protections afforded to those who are protected under status-based prohibitions against discrimination. Now, if you paid attention to that, you recognized two things going on there that are pretty significant. First, what they do is pretty much say Burwell versus Hobby Lobby should be overturned because RFRA should only be applied, in their estimation, to religious institutions or individuals and not necessarily any other type of entity or association, such as a corporation. But second, their formulation of the balance between religious liberty and non-discrimination principles sets on its head the formulation that you have under RFRA or the state correlatives to RFRA. Because remember, under RFRA, the government may not substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability. Except, and here's the exception, government can substantially burden the free exercise if there is a compelling state interest and it's narrowly crafted to serve that interest or the least restrictive means. So the Civil Rights Commission is saying, you know what, you got the horse, you got the cart before the horse. We really think that the burdens should be reversed and primacy should be given to non-discrimination principles. So when you take a look at what the commission is recommending, it would subordinate religious liberty to principles of non-discrimination in a fashion that we've never seen before in our history, and at a time when those principles are going to come into close conflict. With the advent of Obamacare, with the expansion of government into spheres that had been occupied in the past by individual institutions or individuals, with the spread of government subsidization of virtually everything from healthcare to education, and with respect to non-discrimination principles as applied to employment, we're going to be seeing this tension in almost every area of American life. In the past, what we had was more private endeavors, more governance of private endeavors without interference from the government. We ordered ourselves on an individual basis. But what the commission's report suggests, and I think if you look at what's been going on at the various agencies in the guidances that they've been issuing and the administrative instructions and rules and regulations, it's pretty clear that the governing class, or at least large swaths of the governing class, agree with the commission's report in terms of how you order these two principles, with non-discrimination taking primacy over matters of religious liberty. And there are significant consequences. We've already seen that Catholic hospitals, for example, or Catholic adoption agencies have been affected by this. Catholic adoption agencies in several large cities like Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., have had to close down because they run afoul of non-discrimination principles related to placing children with the homes of same-sex couples. We have, most recently, of course, Hobby Lobby. It's also inspired the need for at least consideration for the First Amendment Defense Act. So we're seeing more and more of this on an ongoing basis, and I would suggest that it's going to accelerate even further. So with that, that's the, I guess, the gist of this particular report. For those of you who are wondering, well, what is the import of this report from the standpoint of what government policy is or whether or not it suggests anything in terms of legislation, this report goes to the President and to Congress. It doesn't have any kind of legal effect. But what commission reports have done in the past is inform legislation. It's informed Congress and the President. It's informed agencies in how to administer their various acts. And this will have, I think, some impact. I don't know that there's a great departure between this report and the way this administration operates in the first instance, but I think it provides a platform and support for the direction in which some within the administration and many people in the United States think that the country should be going in terms of the protection of religious liberty versus non-discrimination principles. And with that, I'll leave it open to questions.
Very good, Peter. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. Before we get to the first question, I just want to make one programming note. Our next scheduled telephone conference call will be from our Financial Services Practice Group next Wednesday, October 19th. At 3 p.m., we will host a conversation regarding recent developments at the CFPB, and that call will feature Wayne Abernathy, who is the Executive VP for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and Jerry Lozer, of counsel for Winston & Strawn LLP. Peter, it looks like we have a couple people in line. Let's go to their questions now. Please go ahead.
Hi, Peter. It's Dave Tryon here in Cleveland. How are you?
Good, Dave.
So good. So I've got two questions for you. So first of all, I've been following this stuff for a while, and it looks to me like I'm kind of projecting out 10 years, and I see 10 years out, if we end up with someone, Hillary Clinton's Supreme Court, that we may end up with child protective agencies and other government agencies saying if you are homeschooling your children and teaching them that homosexuality is wrong, then we're going to take your children away from you, or else you have to put them in public school where they don't learn that bigoted type of instruction. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Do you think that's a possibility? And second of all, what do you think about changing the conversation? So instead of calling it religious liberties, we change it to what the liberals love, which is rights. And we say, these are religious rights. Do you think if we change the terminology, if that would change the conversation or the approach at all?
Yeah. Well, thanks, David. First, with respect to homeschooling, if you'd asked me that question a few years ago, I'd say, I'm not sure that we need to be concerned about it. And even though at this particular point, from a federal level, I can't see that necessarily happening. What we see right away, that is, one of the things that alarms some of us is the aggressive stance taken by the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education. And also, when you take a look at the various lobbying arms of the teachers' unions and the approaches that they've been taking, and we see states that are placing more and more requirements on homeschooling. The correlative with adoption agencies, that might be a model that they pursue. And what we've also seen is not merely an attempt to establish principles of non-discrimination, but kind of hortatory attempts on the part of OCR, EEOC, and others to make people think a certain way, and there's only certain permissible courses of action or thought patterns that you may have. It sounds almost bizarre, but we see it quite often in the accommodations areas where we've got, you know, the gay bakers, the same-sex wedding cakes, photographers, and matters of that nature, where we've seen some agreements where the offending party, whether it be a baker or a photographer, says that they will not share their views on traditional marriage, for example, with any customers. So when you see things like that, it's not necessarily a huge leap to say that states may seek to impose certain criteria on homeschoolers in this regard. Again, from a political perspective, I think that's a heavy lift. I know that homeschoolers are not a large swath of the population. They're growing. But I think that it would be politically difficult for I think people get it. I think people would start to say that hits too close to home. And there might be resistance on the state level. But I won't put anything past OCR. If you've seen any things coming out of OCR recently, the sky's the limit. Just use your imagination as to what they may attempt to do. Second is, and by the way, they're very creative when it comes to interpretations of the law, I'll put it mildly. With respect to changing the nomenclature from liberty to rights, I'm not a politician, don't play one on TV also, but I kind of like the term liberty. I understand there are different connotations. When you talk about rights, especially in the present environment, it seems to have greater resonance. You may not violate rights, whereas liberties are, well, people now look at liberties as something government gives. So I'm not sure that changing the nomenclature necessarily changes things. I'm open to the idea. But what I do know is if those who believe in liberty, and remember, this is about religious liberty, but if we don't protect religious liberty, that is, liberty with respect to belief, essentially liberty with respect to thought, then all other liberties are illusory. This is where you have to make a stand. And we've got to be, you know, very measured, very smart about how we accommodate the two concerns of liberty and non-discrimination. And people of goodwill, I think, can make those adjustments and accommodations. And unfortunately, to a large extent, it's got to be done almost on a case-by-case basis. Yeah, you can have a RFRA out there, but then under RFRA, there's going to be case-by-case adjudications as to how, in any given circumstance, you reconcile the two concepts, you know, the undue burdens, so on and so forth. But in any event, David, I'm babbling on here. I don't know that nomenclature ever does anything except, the folks on the other side seem to use nomenclature to their benefit very well. I'm not sure that we're all that capable of doing it.
Peter, we've got a few people waiting in line patiently, so let's go to the next call.
Oh, hi, this is John Guzet with the...
This is Matthew Kaczmarek. I serve as Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty Institute in Dallas, Texas, and we handle cases involving, the clash of absolutes between religious liberty on the one hand and sexual liberty on the other. I was wondering if the commissioner would comment on the concept of third-party harms as a legal principle, and what role the concept of harm has played as that concept is now psychologized to reach sort of psychic harms. Professor Epstein has written persuasively on this subject and argued that there's a metastasization of harms, and using linguistic relativism and other sort of deconstructionist tools, you see this concept of harm grow to reach categories that really don't have an analog in the common law tradition.
Yeah, and what we see very often is an attempt to delegitimize certain liberties because they cause some type of affront to someone's dignity. And this goes back to something I alluded to before, the distinction between liberty and coercion. And again, it could be benevolent coercion, but when you're dealing with non-discrimination principles, what you're doing is utilizing the authority of the state to curb or coerce certain conduct versus liberty, which is, frankly, free of coercion or purportedly free of coercion. And with respect to harms visited on, what's interesting is when you look at third-party harms, one of the harms that you could raise is what I mentioned before in terms of the extinguishment of a number of service organizations because they refuse to check their religion at the door in providing these services. Catholic Charities is a good example when it comes to adoption services. They had almost uniformly, in the places where it had been shut down, been either the primary provision provider of adoption services, or if they weren't the primary provider, they were thought to be the best provider. And they were successful in a number of regards. But because of that, because of their running afoul, purportedly, of non-discrimination principles or refusal to curb their religious beliefs, they were not afforded any type of accommodation. And you would think a reasonable accommodation could be made whereby they could continue to adhere to their religious principles, provide adoption services, and if, you know, someone wanted to go elsewhere for adoption services, they could go elsewhere. I'm not sure if I'm addressing your question directly, but with respect to third-party harms, I see the obverse of third-party harms going on with respect to the imposition of religious imposition of non-discrimination principles in a rigid, formulaic fashion in a way that doesn't seek to accommodate others. For example, I'll give you one more example. You may know that recently, probably within the last 9 months or so, I think it was the state of Tennessee came up with an accommodation for counselors. The accommodation would allow counselors to decline to provide counseling services to individuals whose lifestyles they disagreed with. So, for example, if a counselor had a view toward traditional marriage and was being sought for counseling by someone who was engaged in a same-sex marriage, then that counselor could decline to provide services provided that there were other counselors immediately available to that individual and would provide those services. Unfortunately, there was considerable backlash about that. In fact, on our own commission, the chairman of the Civil Rights Commission said, why do they need accommodation? The services should just be provided, which begs the question, why would anyone want counseling from somebody who disagrees with their lifestyle choices? But nonetheless, I think what we're seeing is a refusal to provide any type of leeway or accommodation very often to individuals who have traditional religious beliefs, and there are harms associated with that and a cascading effect. But in any event, I'm not sure to what extent in terms of jurisprudence you can seize upon those things, but the other side has in terms of third-party harms when it comes to harms to dignity, when it comes to harms to other individuals, and trying to equate, for example, religious belief and adherence to traditional marriage norms to the types of discrimination that were outlawed in Heart of Atlanta Motel. And I know Professor Epstein has written about that also, the use of the Commerce Clause. I'm babbling on again, but that's how I see it.
Peter, we have two people currently waiting to ask questions. I want to note that we had a little software glitch and dropped a prior caller, and I want to encourage that caller to call back. If you want to request the floor, enter star and then the pound sign on your keypad, and we will get to your call, and we will make an attempt to answer all the callers waiting patiently. So let's go to the next call.
Hi, Hi, Peter. This is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And first, thanks for your great work on the commission generally and in particular in this instance. I would like to ask you to elaborate a little bit on what you think the approach ought to be. I mean, you've made a very good case that the approach that's being taken is not the right one, what the approach ought to be, both as a matter of law, constitutional law, and policy, legislative policy. And maybe it would be helpful to do that elaboration in the context of a situation where the power of the federal government is less controversial than it is in the instance of same-sex marriage. I mean, for instance, suppose that you had a private organization that was racist, a public accommodation, like you decided Heart of Atlanta Motel that, refused to accommodate African Americans, or a school that, like Bob Jones, that, had some sort of a racist policy. I think that, any template that we've come up with for how this balance ought to be struck is one that ought to, give us the right answer, not only in instances like same-sex marriage, but also in instances where the discrimination really is discrimination that is constitutionally disfavored. So with that, could you hold forth?
Sure. Yeah, I think, and thanks for the question, Roger. I think, let me just throw out a couple of things. One is that when it comes to principles of non-discrimination, and Heart of Atlanta, for those of you who are listening and not familiar with it, is the case, for example, under the Commerce Clause where, blacks had been prohibited in certain states or areas from going into certain motels and other accommodations. And, because of the effect on commerce, that is, blacks couldn't find any place else to go. That would be or should be covered under non-discrimination principles under the Commerce Clause. There would be jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause. Okay. There's something different between that form of racial discrimination and, say, the gay marriage, same-sex marriage baker controversy or photographer controversy. And that is, if you went to Alabama, and, I kind of resemble this comment because as a little kid, I was, for those of you who don't know because of the strange last name, I'm a black American, but, there are places, large swaths of America where you couldn't find a place, no room at the inn. In 2016, as Professor Epstein has written, and of course he's a little bit more aggressive in this regard than maybe I would be, but there are a host of establishments that will accommodate almost anything an American could want. It's not as if you're completely foreclosed or that there's no room at the inn. And the point I'm trying to make, Roger, is that I think one of the better approaches is under RFRA. Is it perfect? No. And it highlights the difficulty we have in mediating this particular controversy. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act took a very, very difficult predicament and put it kind of in the context, it's similar to the Equal Protection Clause approach under college admissions, although not quite. It has some of the same language. But here, the government cannot substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, unless there's a compelling state interest and you use the least restrictive means. I think that's a pretty good approach, Roger. Now, on a case-by-case basis, we're going to have to fill out the jurisprudence in this regard. It's difficult to predict. I mean, as I said before, some of these principles of non-discrimination have been with us for 5 minutes, and especially after Obergefell, we're going to have to figure out how these things are going to be accommodated. But I think people of goodwill can find means by which to achieve that accommodation. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people, or some people, who aren't of goodwill on either side of the equation. And some people try to mandate not just that you will accommodate them, but you will celebrate them. And that's what, where there's tension with respect to religious belief. Take, for example, the baker or the wedding photographer. In most of those cases, as you know, the respondents who refuse to, for example, bake a cake for a gay wedding ceremony or take wedding photos had in the past provided services to the claimants, to the complainants. What they had refused to do or objected to was to give their imprimatur in a manner that was contrary to their religion to a wedding. And can that be somehow accommodated? Again, this is not necessarily referral related, but I think there are mechanisms by which that can be done. So to answer your question as to what I think is an approach, I think RFRA is about as close as you can get. I think it needs to be tweaked a little bit, possibly. I think we've got a lot of people in Congress right now. Mike Lee, of course, is one of them, that are looking at ways of making sure that we can afford space for both non-discrimination principles and principles of religious freedom. I guess in the United States of America, primacy should be afforded in the close call to liberty. And going back to Professor Harriet's quote of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death versus give me non-discrimination or give me death. I think America was founded on the premise of liberty. Later, we had salutary principles of non-discrimination, but I think if we swallow up liberty, we're going to be in a bad place.
Thank you for your question, Roger. Just a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Okay, let's go to the next question.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Stephen Casey. I do religious liberties litigation, and I have a private law firm in Austin, Texas. One of the things that I think is recurring about this, and you've touched on it obliquely, both by mentioning RFRA and the founder's quotes, is that we're dealing with a worldview issue because our founders had a worldview of religious freedom and that included a transcendent obligation to the duty of a divine sovereign that superseded the power of the state. And the concern I have with RFRA is this. It solely depends on the worldview of the judge. RFRA in and of itself, and the Sherbert test that it came from, functions in reality, even though it looks nice on the outside, functions in reality as a postmodern Trojan horse. And here's what I mean by that. You take three cases dealing with pro-life work. McCullen v. Coakley, which was the free speech case outside the Massachusetts abortion clinic. You've got Hobby Lobby, which was 5-4, right, in favor of the religious adherent. And you have the partial birth abortion ban, Gonzales v. Carhart, that was 5-4 in favor of the religious persons. But McCullen was 9-0. And each one of those used a different constitutional framework. The Hobby Lobby used a RFRA framework. The religious, the framework in Gonzales was this postmodern undue process, whatever that is supposed to be. But yet McCullen was 9-0. And the reason why McCullen, I submit, is 9-0 is because free speech can be evaluated both by a religious rejecting postmodern empiricist and someone who adheres and believes in our founders' transcendent universe. And they can come to the same decision on a speech case because speech bounces off the ceiling. There's nothing from the transcendent other that approaches it. So when we look at what the commission comes out with, I think it's a bellwether that there's the storm is coming, and we people who value religious freedom, we need to remove the power to decide those from the courts and from tribunals, because all RFRA does is drain that definitive power out of the legislature and put it in the hands of a judge, and it's just a roll of the dice as to what that judge is going to believe about transcendence and the duty of man to submit to the obedience of a divine sovereign versus the power of the state.
That sounds like you're describing a certain justice on the Supreme Court. I will say that, unfortunately, though, we have a certain framework in this country also. You know, in a democratic republic where you do have, under Marbury versus Madison, you know, you've got the judicial branch, and they're going to be pronouncing upon things. You've got certain political interests at stake that result in a RFRA, for better or worse. And those of us who believe strongly in religious freedom, believe strongly in natural rights, you know, we may think or we may come to a different conclusion with respect to certain legislation, but in a nation of 320 million people, we've got elected representatives. It's an imperfect system, obviously. And then you've got this legislation that's trying to negotiate differences between two factions or two worldviews, as you put it. And then you've got certain texts that you arrive upon, and a judge is going to interpret it, and it depends on his worldview. And if it's Justice Kennedy's worldview, then it's, well, it's going to be an interesting worldview, to put it mildly. I don't know that there's any better way of approaching this, given the number of interests at stake and given our politics. And I know that sounds like a capitulation to a secularist worldview, but, you know, that's the reality. I do think that we're having significant encroachments upon religious liberty. I'm not sure to what extent you stop it unless you've got, in terms of world view, a revival of sorts among the polity. I think that's the only way of doing it.
I might suggest that as a follow-up, the legislature, because you do have these clash of interests, is where it should be cited. And so we should, because in Texas we have a RFRA that's statutory, but it is one of the longest RFRAs that's out there. And everybody got to play. Everybody got their definition in there, rather than having something short and very vague that gets tossed to the judiciary, because I see that as a power drain out of the power of the people, where the power of in a democratic republic is supposed to lie.
Mm-hmm. That's well taken.
Okay, thank you, Stephen, for your call and your question. We will move to, we've got two people waiting in line to ask their question. Let's go to their question, the first caller's question now.
Hi, this is John Grisey with the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. I was so glad to get the email message saying you were going to be taking part in this teleforum, because I'd been trying to email you earlier in the day to thank you for that marvelous statement that you contributed to the commission's report. I thought it was really masterful, and I just wanted you to know how much I liked it. So now I can tell you orally. I also have one question. Sorry. I also have one specific question about it, though, and I'll go ahead and ask it. You say, and let me find the exact quote here. You talk about the fact that these non-discrimination provisions are all statutory, whereas the religious freedom is protected under the Constitution. But you also say you make an exception for the racial non-discrimination principles embedded in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. My hesitation about that whole analysis is, what about the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment? Don't the people who are interested in non-discrimination on these other grounds cite that as authority?
Right. What I was saying there only is a nod to those who would say that non-discrimination principles at least have some history. You know, I cite statutory non-discrimination principles as embedded in Title VII, ADA, so on and so forth. My point was that the freedom of religion was, at least from the beginning of, or shortly after, the Constitution is embedded in the Bill of Rights, the original Constitution, and that
right.
principles of non-discrimination only came later. It was a rebuttal to what the majority was asserting, that somehow freedom of religion should be subordinate to principles of non-discrimination, or primacy should be afforded to the latter versus the former. That's the
only
point.
Well, that's clearly right. And you make it very well. So that's all. I think that clarifies things. And again, I just want to say that was a great piece of writing. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. But I will tell you, quite frankly, that 99.9% of that is not something that springs forward from my mind. I've got to give a lot of credit to a lot of other people, including my assistant, Commissioner Harriet, and everyone else who informed it, and all the witnesses who appeared before us, many of whom spent lots of time preparing significant statements. This was an important report for them, and I will tell you, I've been on the Civil Rights Commission for 15 years. I'm currently the longest-serving member, and I've seen lots of reports. During that period of time, we've never had as much interest in any other commission report other than this one. Typically, we'll get a few comments from the public. We leave the hearing open so people can submit comments that sometimes are included in the report. But the number of comments we received for this particular topic was through the roof. And those comments were the most erudite comments I can remember reading for any other kind of hearing we had. We received them from bishops and from cardinals and from lay people and tons from students. It was encouraging, and on both sides of the issue. And what I didn't see, peculiarly, in what you would expect out of this, was any kind of enmity. You know, these were people of goodwill. Unfortunately, when this kind of percolates up to the political sphere, people are throwing bombs. But nonetheless, people perceive this as being an important issue. I think they understand what's at stake here. And as I said in the report, in rebuttal to something that a majority commissioner said, the commissioner was giving kind of short shrift to religious liberty. Even if you are not a religious person, this is an issue that should concern you deeply, because it's not simply, and I use that word advisedly with quotation marks, simply, freedom of religion. It's freedom of thought. If your ability to express your innermost beliefs are curbed somehow, that's necessarily going to affect your thought process. And that is the antithesis of any form of liberty, but especially the type of liberty that we sought here in the United States of America. For that reason, I think people intuitively understood this is an issue of grave importance, and we're seeing it being eroded. And we're watching it being eroded very quickly during our lifetimes. And, you know, I don't want to ascribe motives to anyone else. I don't know what's in their hearts. But we're going down a particular path that I see, and we're going to be going down much more quickly over the next 10 to 12 years, not just from a political standpoint, but we've got to watch what's going on in terms of the culture and society generally.
Okay, Peter, we it looks like we have one caller waiting to ask a question. I'd like to get to as many questions as we can. If you want to ask a question, please enter star and then hit pound on your telephone keypad. We'll go to that caller now.
Hello, Peter. This is Bob Davis in Maine. It does seem to me that the idea of religious liberty contains within it the notion of non-discrimination. And that certainly seems justified to me when the non-discrimination is directed at Congress, which the Bill of Rights was directed at Congress, and even through the incorporation doctrine, making it applicable to the states, that seems to be appropriate too. It's still government action. But we're getting perilously close to applying it to individuals, free individuals not having the right to be wrong. And we hear something about that when it comes to man-made global warming, for example, where people shouldn't get elected unless they, you know, sign on to the so-called consensus of scientists. Do you think there's anything that the civil society itself can do to correct this? Because it is still not, these notions are still not pervasive throughout the civil society. Is there anything, for example, that a convention of states could do, you know, to propose to an amendment to clarify some of these issues and bring them back a little closer? I'm thinking in terms of, for example, the term limits on members of the Supreme Court and perhaps three-quarters of the states being able to override a decision of the Supreme Court.
I will tell you, personally, a convention of states is a concept that's way beyond my pay grade. I've thought about it. I've read about it. I've got serious concerns about the viability of it or whether or not it's something that is will result in what we hope it would result in, or many would hope it result in. I think it can sometimes be seen as a Pandora's box. But aside from that, in terms of civil society, I agree with you that this is something that goes beyond politics, that transcends the law. One of the reasons, and I say in my statement, I think one of the reasons we are at this particular pass is because all of the unwritten rules, all of the unwritten law by which we traditionally govern ourselves is changing. It's changing because our culture is changing. It's changing because we're becoming, or in terms of our society is becoming, less religiously based. Fewer people are going to church. The whole notion of religion is not as important or doesn't loom as large in the public psyche as it did even 20 years ago, let alone 150 years ago. And I think our culture is such that society is going in a direction that favors greater secularism and also favors the commission majority's view of the place of religion and religious liberties in society. So as long as we have a culture and society that is trending away from traditional norms with respect to two-parent households, for example, 74% of all black kids are born to a single-parent home. Somebody like that is not going to be getting the kind of traditional religious instruction. They're not going to be going to church the way they would if they were in a two-parent home. And that's not simply black parents either. We've got 40% of Americans like that. When you don't have marriage, you have less inculcation of religious beliefs. If you have less inculcation of religious beliefs, religion loses its importance generally in society. If it loses its importance generally in society, that means politicians and politics are going to be less concerned about it, and therefore our laws are going to reflect that. So
you're
I think, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I'm not a religious person, but I don't think that you have to be a religious person in order to deal with the notion of religious liberty for those who believe it and who want to practice it. So I think you can lay much of this at the feet of the educational institutions that don't really teach that the United States was set up with a purpose to protect and promote individual liberty. And unless you can reach most of the population with the reason why we have separation of powers, federalism, the Declaration, and the desire for individual liberty and what it takes to retain it, I don't think we're ever going to solve this, but I don't think you necessarily need all religious people in order to achieve that. Liberty is something desired by many people, certainly not most people, but desired by many people for its own sake. And what do you think of that?
I agree with you entirely. I know I heard Roger Clegg on the line before. I know he speaks at colleges very often. I speak in high schools, and instruct at high schools, colleges, law schools. And what I see and what I have seen over the last 25, 30 years is it's kind of an astonishing development, even at the law school level, and I teach law school too, is less appreciation or knowledge of founding documents, founding principles, the importance of liberty, generally speaking, there's a complete disregard for the notion of natural rights. And we are seeing, I will just say that a certain worldview is prevailing. And as long as that worldview prevails in our institutions, whether it's academic, whether it's you know, the fact that, as I said, I think religious belief is receding throughout the country, from a political standpoint, it's going to manifest itself in the commission majority's view of the primacy of non-discrimination principles over religious liberty. And that's the way they view it. Even though, as you say, as you know, religion can incorporate or assumes in many regards what many would regard as non-discrimination, that's not the way the majority on the commission view it. They view it as either or, and they view religion as something that is antithetical to. Now, I don't want to necessarily make this hyperbolic, but the commission chairman's own statement seems to suggest that religion is the enemy of non-discrimination.
Okay, Peter, we are running a little short on time, but we do have, I think we can squeeze in one last question before we conclude.
I have one conundrum in the religious freedom department, and that is that there is a religious, at least one religious sect that believes that that it's their duty to enslave and tax infidels and kill apostates. And that's completely inconsistent with our view of religious freedom in the United States. So what does one do about it? It's possible that Obamacare was engineered with the idea that you should tax non-Muslims differently than Muslims, in that Muslims have a religious exemption because insurance is gambling, as far as they're concerned. Comments?
Well, we do have a whole host of cases from the Supreme Court, many of which those on the line may have disagreements with or quibble with at the very least. But the practice of religion is not a complete license to do whatever one wishes without regard to strictures placed upon our society by the state. And I'll go back to RFRA, and I understand that some of you are not big fans of RFRA, but it is an attempt to mediate these two concerns of the place of the state in non-discrimination and religious liberty. There is not an unabridged right to do whatever your religion says you should do. And if there is a religion that has concepts antithetical to our notion of government and society, well, those can be circumscribed. And we've got, you know, Supreme Court decisions that say that. We've got the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that gives broad berth. But when you talk about some of the things that you just mentioned, you know, there is no place in society where a religion, if that is in fact a religious belief, allows one to, you know, engage in any kind of violent acts against someone else. So I think this particular report doesn't address something of that nature. And I think that's because it's assumed that we're operating within a certain universe, and that universe presumes that certain religious beliefs, if in fact they truly are sincerely held religious beliefs that are nonetheless harmful to society as a whole, you know, we've got all the old cases with respect to, you know, the peyote cases, one of which, you know, is, you know, the employment division versus, or I'm sorry, the, gosh, I can't even remember the name of the case now, but it's right after employment division versus Smith. It'll come to me right after I get off the phone. But to answer your question, yeah, there are certain precepts of almost every religion that if you play them out literally, do not conform themselves to the way we've constructed our society as a democratic republic. but I think we've got considerable jurisprudence that says there's a means and mechanism to curb that.
Well, Peter, just like the commission's report, there's certainly a lot of interest from our members. We've had a lot of callers on today and a lot of questions. Is there anything that you'd like to conclude with right now?
Well, what I'd like to conclude with is that, and I appreciate everyone's patience and indulgence on this, this was an important report. This is an extremely important issue. I know all of you who are on this call are going to be engaged because you got on this call, but it's important that we remain engaged on this issue. One of the reasons I wanted this report done is because I saw there being an increasing danger in government encroachment on traditional religious beliefs, practices, and circumscribing the same. So if you do anything, you may want to log on to what some of the folks are doing in Congress. You know, Mike Lee has been active on this. Other congressmen have been active on this. You've got, issues with respect to the First Amendment Defense Act. A lot of hard work needs to be done in this regard, and I would encourage you to sign up wherever you can. I know a number of you have already engaged more so than I am in this endeavor, so I think it's an important thing to continue to do, and thanks very much.
Very good. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you, Peter, for your time and expertise and joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.